When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Chapter 9 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Garibaldi's Mistakes in Naples. The Check Before Capua. A qualche anno di tutti questo piccoli qua, c'è ora ci preoccupano tanto ci ricordar. Di una cosa sola de ricorderemo tutti per sempre. Ci ricorderemo ci in questi due anni se fatta Italia. Massoni's saying in the winter of 1860. In a few years, who will recollect all these little troubles which now obsess our minds? One thing only we shall all of us remember forever. We shall remember that in these 2 years Italy was made. On September 8th, the day after Garibaldi's entry, the Bourbon commandant of the castle San Elmo sent word that he could no longer restrain his men from bombarding the city at their feet. "Very well," said the dictator. "Let them fire, and we will fire back." He had on that day no military force in Naples except the National Guard, who were fit only for policing the streets. But his fearless tone quelled the enemy's soldiers. They did not open fire, and in the course of the next 3 days handed over all the four castles to the National Guard. None of the outgoing regiments would listen to the invitations to desert that were showered upon them, but marched off scowling at the people, full of zeal to join their king and comrades in the last stand behind the Volturno. The loyalty of the army to the Bourbons, even stronger among the rank and file than among the officers, defeated the calculations alike of Garibaldi and of Cavour, who had each confidently expected that if the revolution succeeded at all, the army would come over wholesale to aid the wars of liberation for the rest of the peninsula. The loyalty of the soldiers was a measure of their professional feeling and of their isolation from the community at large, to whom they had been related not as defenders of the fatherland or representatives of the national honor, but as the tyrant's bodyguard kept to repress the citizens. Therefore they were left untouched by the tide of popular sentiment for united Italy, and while half of them rallied around Francis II at Capua and Gaeta, the other 50,000 disbanded and went sulkily to their homes or took to the hills as brigands. In the north of the kingdom, where a part of the population itself was reactionary under clerical influence, there ensued a state of sporadic civil war, of which the worst horrors had been spared to the southern provinces. On September 8th, news reached the dictator from the district of Ariano, to the east of the capital, that Generals Bonanno and Flores, with 4,000 Bourbon troops, had there roused up the royalist peasantry, who were robbing, massacring, and raping in the houses of the liberals. The first 1,500 of Garibaldi's army who arrived in Naples on the 9th were allowed only a few hours' rest before they were sent off again to quell the insurrection. Tour, who went in command, took them by train to Nola, there put them into carts and carriages, and drove with the utmost speed to the scene of operations. Bonanno, in spite of his superior numbers, agreed without a blow to disband his force. It appears that conversations with comrades returning to their homes from Calabria had so much discouraged his men that he no longer dared rely upon them to fight. Tour acted not only with vigor but with clemency. He shot two of the ringleaders of the peasant massacre, though the local liberals who had suffered begged him to shoot around a dozen, and disliked the practical application of his doctrine that a new era of liberty and brotherhood had dawned for all Italians. The repression of similar reactionary massacres in Molise and the Abruzzi was conducted by General Cialdini, and the Piedmontese regulars in the later months of the year was on a scale of vengeance more calculated to satisfy the local demand than anything that Garibaldi or his lieutenants were ever known to permit. The arrival in Naples of the rest of the army from Calabria and Basilicata was accelerated by the help of the newly acquired shipping of the port. Some of the regiments in the rear were brought by sea to Paola and some from Sapri, while others marched. The last division under Medici reached Naples on September 15th and the following days. In the course of a quarrel at Paola for the first passage on board a steamer, Nino Bixio had broken the heads of several of his companions in arms with the butt end of a musket. As usual, he repented of his savage rage and made friends with the victim whom he had nearly killed. Cavour was agreeably surprised by the dictator's first acts in Naples. On the evening of his entry, before he lay down to rest, he had issued a decree generously handing over the whole Neapolitan fleet to King Victor Emmanuel and placing it forthwith under the orders of Admiral Persano, to the detriment of his own power and authority. 3 days later he invited a battery of Piedmontese artillery and a battalion of Bersaglieri in the harbour to land and to cooperate with him in garrisoning Naples. He also chose moderates and Cavourians as his ministers, among others Liborio Romano, whom he continued in the offices which he had held under Francis II. These first steps, taken as Cavour knew on the advice of the sage Cosenz, proved to all the world that no thought lurked in Garibaldi's mind of any ultimate settlement for Sicily and Naples, except union under the monarchy of Victor Emmanuel. But he intended to postpone that union until he could proclaim the King of Italy on the capital, and he publicly announced that he would march on Rome over the last ruins of the Neapolitan army on the Volturno. The desire to march to the deliverance of the Holy City was inspired in his mind not by political calculation, but by poetic passion, by the memories of antiquity, and of his own defense of the Janiculum in 49. The romantic element was the strongest in his nature and ruled him for good or evil at all the great crises of his life. The lover's passion for Rome was fostered in him by Bertani and the other extremists, who saw in it a means towards their own political ends. It was to them a method of delaying annexation until it could be effected on terms fatal to Cavour's continuance in office and dangerous to the prestige of the monarchy, which would be reduced to the position of accepting the crown of Italy as a gift at the hands of the revolutionary leader. Garibaldi and the Mazzinians were alike under a delusion as to the practicability of taking the city of Rome. They believed that the French people were on the Italian side in this matter, and that the tyrant, Napoleon III, when seriously challenged, would be forced to withdraw his garrison from Rome for fear of revolution in France. They were equally wrong about Prince and the people. In reality, the clerical and anti-Italian feeling of France of that day was the main reason why Napoleon could not utterly desert the Pope, for whom at heart he had little love. Until, in the latter half of September, it became apparent that the Bourbon forces rallied behind the Volturno were strong enough to check Garibaldi's advance on Rome. Cavour was at his wit's end for ways and means to prevent a complication which must involve Italy, either in civil war or in war with France. Knowing that he had lost all influence of his own with the dictator, Cavour turned in every direction to find others who could remonstrate with better chance of success. At his instigation, Kossuth wrote to Garibaldi, congratulating him on his triumphs in the cause of freedom, and imploring him not to embroil Italy with France in a quarrel under the walls of Rome that could only redound to the advantage of Austria at the expense of Hungary and of Venice. Cavour even commandeered the services of the English to remonstrate with their favourite. Lord Shaftesbury wrote from London to tell Garibaldi that he gave thanks to God for his success, and to conjure him not to imperil it by attacking the Pope too soon. Even Edwin James, the barrister on a holiday, had been set on to use his influence with the dictator in favour of immediate annexation. Persano implored Admiral Mundy, for whom Garibaldi had conceived a great affection since the events of Palermo, to persuade his friend not to advance on Rome. Lord John Russell had instructed Elliot, the British minister to the deposed king, to remain at Naples, and if possible to dissuade its new master from attacking Venice. Elliot and Mundy therefore arranged an unofficial meeting between themselves and Garibaldi in the cabin of HMS Hannibal. It took place on September 10th. Bertani, who followed the dictator about like his evil genius, had to be asked twice to quit the cabin before he would leave his victim alone with the two Englishmen. His fears on this occasion were groundless, for Garibaldi, though cordial and patient, was impervious to all representations of the dangers into which his further advance would plunge Italy. He repeated in a tone of enthusiasm that he would first crown Victor Emmanuel in Rome, and that then the task of liberating Venice would devolve upon the king. The conduct of Bertani in Naples was unworthy of his former great services to Italy. He, who had once done so much to bring together Garibaldi and Cavour, now worked only too successfully to divide them. He became the mouthpiece of self-seeking politicians, like Rattazzi and his friends, who, hoping to step into Cavour's ministerial shoes, were not ashamed to write that Garibaldi was the only person who could strike him down. Urged on by such counsellors, Bertani daily inflamed the dictator's hatred against the man who had sold Nice, regardless of the fact that the man was now in consequence liberating the papal marches. Garibaldi published a letter stating that he could never again work with Cavour, and then sent a note to Victor Emmanuel, asking him to dismiss his great minister. Bertani indeed advised Garibaldi against this step, not because he wished Cavour to remain in office, but because he rightly foresaw that the request would be refused, and Cavour's position strengthened. Unlike Rattazzi, Bertani was at least disinterested. He was not seeking Cavour's place, but the union of Italy. He had impaired his health and his mental balance by working day and night on his sickbed at Genoa, organizing half the forces by means of which Garibaldi had reached Naples. He had brought on Italian unity by such great strides that year that he could not believe it necessary to call a halt. He had, by his rival activities, compelled Cavour to invade the Papal States himself, and he could not see that, although, thanks to Cavour's manipulation of Napoleon, Umbria and the marches were fair game, France still threw her shield over the city of Rome. On September 19th, he persuaded the dictator to send round 300 men under Catalini to land at Terracina in the Papal States, in order to prepare the way for the advance of the main Garibaldian army on Rome. The orders for this foolish expedition were actually given, but were rescinded at the advice of Sertori. Garibaldi's military lieutenants, Sertori, Cosenz, Tur, Medici, and Bixio, were all opposed to the extravagant counsels of the civilians, Bertani, Crispi, and Mazzini. For Mazzini, too, was in Naples. He arrived on September 17th, and remained not in hiding, but in obscurity. A stranger who met him one evening in a private house, without knowing at first who he was, describes him as an old man with a sweet voice, saying wise and noble things to a group of Garibaldian officers who listened to his words with profound respect. When he touched actual politics, he was less happily inspired. He wrote on September 23rd to Garibaldi, saying that he preferred not to come to see him in the crowd at the Palazzo d'Agri, but that he hoped the dictator would offer these terms to Victor Emmanuel, immediate annexation of Naples in return for the dismissal of Cavour and war with the Austrians and Venetia. The dictator would probably have been better pleased if Mazzini had stayed away, but since he had come he would listen to no suggestion for sending him back, and when the scum of Naples shouted, "Death to Mazzini!" under his windows, Garibaldi protected him and rebuked the rioters. To the men who were making Italy, Mazzini's arrival in Naples was an exasperating addition to the dangers of the gamble on which their country's existence was staked. So long as he continued to play a part, and a mistaken part upon the whole, in political affairs it was impossible for all men to give the father of Italian unity his meed of thanks, and to be always remembering that but for his work in the 30s and 40s there would have been no 1860. Throughout this year, when his life's work was being brought to fruition by others, Mazzini was in a state of melancholy resignation, for although he felt confident that the union of Italy was at hand, it was not the idealist Italy which he had striven to evoke. He sought no thanks for himself from the country which he had made, and dreamt of no apotheosis, but only of a speedy end to life in his English land of exile, now grown dear to him. "Unity," he writes to Mrs. Taylor, "you may consider as settled, and so far, so good. The rest is all wrong. And as for myself, don't talk of either prosperity or consciousness of having done, etc. All that is chaff. The only real good thing would be to have unity achieved quickly through Garibaldi, and 1 year before dying of Walham Green or Eastbourne. Long silences, a few affectionate words to smooth the ways, plenty of seagulls and sad dozing. Except that there was less unanimity on behalf of the national cause, the attitude of the people of Naples after the entry of Garibaldi closely resembled that of the people of Palermo 3 months before. In Naples, as in Palermo, devotion to the person of the liberator was deep and genuine, and did not grow less on closer acquaintance. The southern populations found him far more simpatico than they found other northerners, and when he retired in November and left them to the Piedmontese officials, they soon wished him back again. But so long as he was with them, though they were never tired of cheering him, they were annoyed by his policy of postponing the annexation, in which alone they saw a sure way of safety. The reason why the Neapolitans shouted death under the windows of Mazzini was that he opposed immediate and unconditional annexation. They wished Victor Emmanuel would come at once to give them security and peace. The impatience of the Neapolitans with the interim government of the dictator was increased by faults of administration. Many common convicts were led out of prison on the ground that they were political prisoners, and stabbing and crime grew more rife than ever. The moderate ministers whom Garibaldi had chosen on his first entry found themselves overridden by the dictator's secretary, Bertani, who treated them as ciphers and carried on the most important acts of government without consulting them. On September 22nd, the ministry sent in their resignation. 5 days later it was accepted, and their places were taken by more passive tools of the omnipotent secretariat. The despotism of Bertani and of Crispi, who succeeded him on September 30th as secretary without altering the policy pursued, would have been endured gladly if it had meant order and a peaceable transition towards the approaching regime of Italian unity. But it seemed rather to tend to anarchy and maladministration. The hopes of the reactionaries revived, and seditious correspondence was sent on foot between Naples and Gaeta. Neither Garibaldi nor Bertani had any conception of the proper limits to which a provisional government should confine its work, and many of their decrees made important changes in the principles of law, finance, and state machinery, which should have been left to the mature decision of the future Italian Parliament. Europe was justly shocked by a dictatorial decree giving a pension to the mother of Agesilao Milano, the idealist fanatic who had attempted to assassinate Bomba, Though it is possible to plead in mitigation of Garibaldi's offense, the flattery long bestowed on Milano's memory by eminently respectable persons in England as well as in Italy. A more innocent act of patronage was more loudly blamed in Naples. The dictator nominated Alexandre Dumas as honorary director of the National Museum and Excavations. Dumas, who really loved the Italian cause and had, in his swaggering way, done more for it than was pleasing to the government and the fashionable classes of his own country, was ungratefully accused by the Neapolitans of dipping his fingers into their public purse. It was true that if he had not undertaken the duties of the directorate for nothing, it might have been given as a paid post to some native. The appointment of a foreigner was unwise, apart from all question of the novelist's equipment as an archaeologist. But Dumas was subjected to much undeserved abuse. All these political questions and quarrels revolving around the central problem, whether or not annexation should be immediate and unconditional, found their solution in military events against which there was no appeal. The check of Garibaldi before Capua and the success of Victor Emmanuel's troops in the Papal States. In return for the supreme sacrifice of his capital, King Francis had obtained a new position of strength, geographically and politically suited for a successful rally of the royalist element in the army and the kingdom. Gaeta afforded a secure base of operation, and in the event of defeat, a last stronghold which could hold out for months, even against a regular army with siege guns. But the front line of defense was the northern bank of the lower Volturno, a deep, muddy river, fordable at widely scattered points known as scafe or ferries. The only bridge was that which led into Capua. The celebrated Monsieur Vauban, whose creation so often baffled William III and retarded Marlborough, had designed the defenses of Capua, and they had been modernized and enlarged by a Russian military architect as late as 1855. The bastions were well furnished with cannon, provided strong enough to oppose a final limit to Garibaldi's career of victory. This impregnable tête-du-pont of Capua enabled the Bourbon troops to cross the river whenever they wished and to debouch on the cultivated plain on the south bank, which was admirably suited for the operations of regular troops against ill-disciplined levies. Behind these strong barriers raised by art and nature, the royalists rallied around their king. There was no longer any constitutional ministers or any officers or privates of doubtful loyalty to create an atmosphere of division and distrust. The white flag of the Bourbons was again unfurled. The tricolor and the constitution were stowed away together, and reactionary passions were no longer discouraged and concealed. In the course of September, some 50,000 soldiers assembled in the lines, some of them from distant parts of the kingdom, all having come voluntarily and out of genuine devotion to a fallen cause. The privates were still the most enthusiastic grade in the service, but disloyal officers were no longer to be found in the camp. The fighting spirit shown by the Bourbon troops in the battles of September and October, after the capital had been surrendered without a blow, contrasts strangely with the manner in which they had fled and disbanded in August, when the royal cause had been in a far less desperate condition. The change was partly due to the presence of the king in their midst, and to the fact that they no longer had half-hearted friends within and a hostile population around. But there always remains something inscrutable to northerners and the vagaries of the southern temperament. The Volturno region was not only military, but politically well chosen. The peasants were the most reactionary in the kingdom, and the friendly border of the Papal States was close in the rear. There was suggested in high quarters that the Moriceri, who commanded the Pope's army of foreign crusaders in Umbria, should make a forced march southward, unite with King Francis' troops, and carry him back in triumph to Naples. On the advice of Persigny, the French ambassador in London, King Francis telegraphed from Gaeta to ask for the Pope's consent to this plan. But the invasion of the Papal States by the armies of Victor Emmanuel from the north gave the Pope's generals plenty to do at home. The Bourbon position on the Volturno was by no means merely defensive. It threatened Naples, which was divided from Capua by no more than 18 miles of flat ground, well supplied with country roads concentrating on the capital. Garibaldi's nominal attack on Capua soon became no better than a defense of Naples conducted with great difficulty and peril before the gates of Capua. To the 50,000 Bourbon regulars gathered behind the Volturno, Garibaldi by the end of September opposed some 20,000 volunteers. Besides his own field army, there were insurrectionary bands and private regiments enlisted throughout all the provinces under his dictatorship. When his forces were paid off in November, it was stated officially that as many as 50,000 names appeared on the muster rolls, but Garibaldi himself declared that only a third of those enrolled ever came near the scene of actual conflict. Sicily held 7 out of the 50,000, and besides those who were engaged in garrisoning and patrolling the capital and the southern provinces, thousands of ne'er-do-wells drew pay for trailing rifles and sabers in the cafes of Naples and parading themselves along the streets in uniforms of many colors. The force actually at the front, varying during September and October from 15,000 to 20,000 men, was mainly composed of northern volunteers. But there were among them 3,000 Calabrians and Lucanians, and about as many Sicilians. The city of Naples, so Tor reported in the middle of October, had sent exactly 80 of her 500,000 inhabitants to join the army protecting her on the Volturno. Dispassionate observers of the Garibaldini in that autumn agreed that they contained the cream and the dregs of the nation. When the 1,000 sailed for Sicily in May, there had been no dregs, but the process of adulteration had been continuous ever since. The bad element increasing in exact proportion to the success already achieved until, after the occupation of Naples, the red shirt covered as much heroism and baseness as has ever been concealed by cloth of any color. Garibaldi's lifelong dream of the levée en masse of regenerated Italians, which was to sweep French and Austrian back across the Alps, wreaked itself on the realities of human nature and the stern requirements of effective military organization. Instead of the 150,000 men for whom he had hoped, he got 50,000, out of whom perhaps not more than half could look the enemy in the face. But of these, several thousands were of really heroic mold, and it was these few who saved Italy on the Volturno. The further supply of the best sort of fighters had been cut off by Cavour, who since the middle of August had stopped the exodus of volunteers from Genoa and the north. By cutting off the supply of men, Cavour secured his object of rendering Garibaldi too weak to attack Rome, but in doing so he nearly caused him to lose Naples. Garibaldi's headquarters were established in the palace at Caserta. This monotonous and gigantic edifice is at least more pleasing than Versailles, in imitation of which it was built by Vanvitelli, architect to Carlos III, Bomba's great-grandfather. It has been reared upon the plain, but a mile behind it, at the end of the long palace garden, rises a steep mountain range of white limestone, on the top of which can be seen in the distance the ruined castle and hill town of Old Caserta. Out of the mountainside spouts and tumbles a force of water, conducted from 20 miles away into that arid region by the great aqueduct of Vanvitelli, which spans the Matalone Valley with a structure worthy of imperial Rome. Below the cataract at Caserta, the water glides more gently toward the palace, from basin to basin, between groups of classical statues and dark groves of evergreen. At such pains was this artificial river brought to the king's country seat by the first and most popular of the Neapolitan Bourbons, who realized the highest ideal of kingship as understood under the ancient regime, for he did not forget to send on the water to irrigate the plain and to supply the capital. Carlos III died the year before the French Revolution began, and his descendants failed to adapt themselves to the new era. And so now, among these groves so long reserved for princes, the Garibaldini were encamped, poaching the royal peasants, much to the subsequent scandal of Victor Manuel's lackeys, who thought that the sacred birds ought to have been kept till their master arrived to shoot them. While the advanced guard over against Capua held Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo in Formus, the reserve was bivouacked in the courtyards and gardens of Caserta Palace, and on the great parade ground that lies between it and the station. As in the palace at Palermo, Garibaldi and his staff occupied some of the smallest rooms they could find. The dictator enjoyed this much of kingly pomp, that whenever he appeared, in the field or in the street, any band that perceived him at once struck up Garibaldi's hymn. And he was now attended by a bodyguard of red shirts, whom it amused him to arm with a set of pompous halberds from one of the staterooms of the palace. The principal duty of the bodyguard was to save him from the hundreds of petitioners who besieged his door day and night, clamoring for offices and pensions, and for revenge upon their private enemies. Rival committees mutually denouncing each other as Bourbonists with the envenomed sycophancy of the Levantine revolted the soul of Garibaldi. He passed them on as far as might be to Britannian Naples, and was glad to spend all the hours of daylight on horseback upon the mountains, whither they could not follow him. But when he returned to Caserta each night, he found them still at their posts before his door. His habit of retiring at nightfall and rising before dawn saved him from prolonged contact with this human plague. At Caserta he was always up and about before his staff. Once, indeed, shortly after midnight, while Nulo and Zasio were sitting in the outer room, having held festival over some simple luxuries of the camp, their chief came out from his bedroom, fresh from sleep and booted for the day. He nodded and smiled to them as he passed out, and they could only look up at each other foolishly enough to murmur, "He gets up too soon." Thus abroad bedtimes, he proceeded every day to visit the outposts, travelling from Caserta to Santa Maria by train or by carriage, and thence riding along the lines to the village of Sant'Angelo, built at the foot of the mountain out of the ruins of Roman pleasure villas. Thence he would climb on foot to the summit of Monte Tifata, or to the ruined chapel of San Nicola a few yards below, where once a temple of Jupiter had overlooked the rich Capuan plain. Monte Tifata, the most westerly spur of the mountains that lie between the Caudine Forks and Capua, is also one of the highest peaks of the group. It rises almost 2,000 feet sheer out of the seaward level. Half its flanks are clothed with forests, and half are naked limestone with shrubs and flowers breaking out between the white rocks. Arrived at its summit, Garibaldi felt safe from sycophants and political tormentors of every kind. Here he spent many happy hours in the September sunshine, watching through his telescope the movements of his own and of the enemy's columns. On clear days he had the view of every winding of the Volturno, from the ferry of Cagliazzo to the sea, and each of the ribbon of road on the vast plain stretching on all sides of Capua. It was from Monte Tifata that Hannibal had watched, week after week, for the glint of sunshine upon armor, which might betray to him some cautious move of Fabius in the plain below, when they too matched wits and Capua was the prize. And now, from the same rocks, Garibaldi in his turn was watching the red and blue pieces in the game of chess, to which he had challenged the Bourbon generals. The proper strategy for the royalists to adopt would have been the very opposite to the delay by which Fabius restored the fortunes of Rome. They should have attacked in the middle of September, while Garibaldi's position at Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo was still a skeleton line. Marshal Ritucci, the commander-in-chief at Capua, unlike the generals of Sicily and Calabria, was neither a coward nor a fool, but he failed to grasp the need for instantly taking the offensive. Overawed by Garibaldi's unbroken record of victory, he preferred Fabian tactics, being sure that he could hold Capua against him. No doubt he calculated that when the dictator's advance was shown to be permanently checked, his political hold on Naples and South Italy would relax and his volunteer forces melt away. And there was talk of help in a few months' time from Austria or the Pope. Ritucci's plan was well laid, but he had forgotten Cavour. It was the Piedmontese and not the Austrians, Victor Emmanuel and not Lamoriciere, who arrived to decide the well-balanced struggle on the banks of the Volturno. End of chapter 9. Chapter 10 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Cavour invades the Papal States with the army of Piedmont. Sulle dentate, scilente vete, salta e comiscio, tuona la valanga, e ghiacci in mani, rotolando per lei, selve crociante, mata I silenzi del fuso azzurro, esce no sole l'aquila, e distende in tardi, rota digradante, il nero volo solenne. Salve Piemonte! A te con melodia, mesta da lungi, risonte come, gli epica canti de tuo popol bravo, sendono I fiumi, sendono piene rapidi, gigliardi, come I tuoi central battaglioni e a valle, cercan le desta a ricionar di gloria, villa e sidati. Carducci, Piemont. Over the glittering, jagged summit, leaps the chamois, sounds the avalanche off the cruel ice beds rolling through crashing forests. Out from the silence, out from the encircling blue, floats in the sun the eagle and extends in circles slowly earthward borne his dark and solemn flight. Hail Piedmont! Hail to thee with melody sad from afar, resounding, like the songs, the heroic songs of thine own mountaineers, thy rivers fall. Down fall thy rivers, rushing, rapid, full, like thy battalions in the plain below, seeking the hamlets and the towns astir, with thoughts of glory. The States of the Church, spreading across the peninsula from sea to sea, opposed to a geographical veto to the Union of Italy which Garibaldi's successes in the South had brought into the region of practical politics. At the moment of his entry into Naples, the whole of central Italy from Ancona to Civita Vecchia, from Perugia to Terracina, was still, in the most literal sense, subject to priestly rule. In the papal territories, priests were legislators and the administrators, not, like William of Wykeham or Wolseley, lending their abilities to the state at the invitation of the lay power, but acting in their own divine right. Both in theory and in practice, priests were the sole judges of what might be punished, said, or done by the millions of laymen who chanced to be subjects of the Pope. There was no longer, as in 1848, any attempt at reform from within or concession to the laity. "We are advised to make reforms," said Pio Nono to Odo Russell, the British resident at Rome. "Is it not understood that those very reforms which would consist in giving this country a government of laymen would make it cease to exist? It is called the States of the Church, and that is what it must remain." While many of the parish priests, as soon afterwards appeared, shared the desire of their flocks to be ruled by the King of Italy instead of by the Pope, the Roman Curia was implacable. At no period was the spirit of priestly intolerance and interference exercised with greater impolicy than in these years and months when the threatening theocracy had its last chance of making terms with the modern world. Up to the very day of reckoning, the hierarchy seemed to find a pleasure in reminding every layman in central Italy that he had belonged to an enslaved class and must submit to any humiliation or injustice that the Church was pleased to impose. On August 22, 1860, Odo Russell sent home to Lord John an official dispatch narrating the characteristic incident of papal rule. a respected tradesman of Civita Vecchia died some days since, and five young men, friends of the deceased, wishing to show the respect and affection they bore towards him, applied to the ecclesiastical authority for permission to carry his coffin themselves, instead of allowing it to be carried by the religious confraternity on whom funeral functions usually devolve. The request was granted at Civita Vecchia, but it appears not approved in Rome, for after 4 days the young men were arrested in the night at their own houses by papal gendarmes and conveyed to prison, and the next day they were sent to the state prisons of Soriano beyond Viterbo, where they will in all probability remain for some months and then be released without trial. The charge brought against them is interference with ecclesiastical customs and privileges. This system of government was perpetuated no longer by the submissiveness of the Pope's subjects, but by the presence of foreign armies. The troops of Napoleon III held down Rome and the patrimony of San Peter. An army of Austrians in the pay of Pio Nono maintained order in Umbria and the Marches. In the summer of 1859, these eastern provinces had nominally been evacuated by Austria, but the very same officers and men who had composed the former garrison had been encouraged by the government of Vienna to go back 6,000 strong and enroll themselves in the papal service. Thus, the newly liberated Romagna was threatened from the south by the papal forces, of which these Austrians were the main strength, and from the north by the official army of Austria in the Venetian territory. Cavour had no time to lose. He must overwhelm the Pope's army in Umbria and the Marches and make Italy one by joining hands with Garibaldi in Naples. If he delayed it, it was clear that Austria, as soon as she had recuperated her strength after her losses in the War of 1859, would reconquer North Italy in alliance with the Pope. Cavour, well aware of the necessity for invading the Papal States, knew that the indispensable condition of success in an enterprise so repugnant to the interests of Austria was the passive consent of the ruler of France. The French Emperor had no good will for the Austrians who were maintaining the Pope's temporal power on the eastern seaboard of Italy, although he still found himself compelled to do similar police work in the west. Napoleon's throne depended upon the support of the Pope's followers in France, and the Pope's temporal power in Rome depended on Napoleon's bayonets, so each must perforce accommodate the other. But the chain of their mutual dependence was galling, and only made them hate one another the more. Napoleon, half a liberal and wholly a man of the modern world, detested the obscurantist government, of which he was the unwilling protector, while the Pope and the Curia, after the Franco-Austrian War of 1859, recollected that the third Napoleon was the nephew of the first, and thenceforward chose to regard him as the embodiment of the European Revolution. They entertained high hopes of a Bourbon restoration in France, and began to talk of the present occupant of the Tuileries in the language which cardinals and papal secretaries now sleeping in silent Rome cloisters had used in their day about Queen Elizabeth and Henry of Navarra. The French ambassador reported with amused indignation that, according to His Holiness Irish Chamberlain, Napoleon III was in league with the devil, and often consulted him on political affairs. Pio Nono considered that Napoleon had deprived him of the Romagna by the War of 1859, and that he was preparing at the earliest opportunity to rob him of Umbria and the Marches. "Caramio Russell," he said in his mild and benevolent voice to the British resident, "you are mistaken if you take the present crisis in Italy for a national one. What is being done now will be undone again in time. Piedmont is an instrument in the hands of the Emperor Napoleon, who thinks it his duty to carry out the idea of his uncle. What his ultimate objects are, I know not, but whatever he establishes will end with him as the kingdom of his uncle ended with the empire. The Italians are not bad people, but they are easily led astray by foreign agents, who revolutionize the country for their own wicked purposes. When they have suffered more, they will repent and return to us." Misled by the false historical analogy of a bygone period, when France had imposed the revolutionary system on Italy from without, the Pope and his advisers persuaded themselves that no genuine national movement existed in the peninsula and looked forward to another 1815, another fall of Napoleon, and another restoration of the old Italian world. Even so shrewd a man as Cardinal Antonelli, who shared but few of the illusions of his rivals round the papal throne, declared that he was waiting for the 1815 of the Second French Empire, after which the Pope would enjoy his own again in the Romagna and elsewhere. The Second French Empire has indeed since then met with its Waterloo, but it is not the Pope or the ancient regime that has risen on its ruins. The Pope, having quarrelled with his bread and butter in the shape of Napoleon's protection, was easily persuaded in the early months of 1860 to entrust his fortunes to the Belgian fanatic de Merode, whose grand design it was to enlist an army of crusaders gathered from all parts of Europe, which should be strong enough to defend the papal territories, and also enable the Holy Father to dispense with the degrading patronage of the French usurper. Cardinal Antonelli, indeed, who saw what was possible in this life as clearly as any other worldling in Europe, argued that a mistake was being made in trying to turn the Holy See into a military power. But his warnings were drowned in the clamorous joy of the church militant over the energy and zeal of his Belgian rival. Antonelli was forced to bide his time and allow the fatal experiment to be tried. The hour belonged to Monsignor de Merode, the priest and war minister. All through the spring and summer of 1860, the quiet piazza of old papal Rome resounded with clash and tramp of regiments under arms and the cries of officers drilling recruits in all the languages of Catholic Europe, while the French garrison, no longer the heroes of the sacristy, stared at the crusaders with mingled envy and contempt. By September, de Merode's army numbered not less than 15,000 men. Of these, the weakest regiments, with the exception of one or two battalions, were the native subjects of the Pope, enlisted for the sake of the pay, without zeal for the cause, despised by their foreign companions in arms, and conscious that they were traitors to their own country. The foreign troops were, on the average, superior in quality. 6,000 Austrian veterans and several hundreds of Irish recruits were landed, enrolled, and drilled at Ancona. In Rome, there were more Irish, besides French, Belgians, and other nationals. They were essentially crusaders, not mercenaries. The Irish, as was justly observed, could have obtained far better terms in the Queen's service, and had come solely out of religious zeal. Peasants straight from the soil of Ireland, they were riotous and difficult to manage, but by the influence of their priests rather than by the enforcement of strict military discipline, they were at length reduced to order and presented a soldierly appearance in their green uniforms. But the troops who attracted most attention in this strange army were the French and Belgians of good family who assumed the title of Papal Zouaves. They were the men of the ancient regime, strayed into the wrong century, who had at last found a cause for which they could fight. They involved the whole army in the atmosphere of their own extreme legitimist principles. Napoleon III was to them a usurper and a Jacobin. They proclaimed a royalist restoration was imminent, and cheered for Henry V of France under the windows of Napoleon's officers in Rome. In all this they were encouraged by the party now supreme at the Vatican, who spared the emperor no insult. De Merode in March had visited France and returned with a kinsman of his own, the retired French general Lamoriciere, once a republican, now a legitimist and clerical, but always openly hostile to the Napoleonic Empire. This man was put in command of the army of crusaders, as if to show that the Pope no longer valued Napoleon's friendship and had no more need for his protection. If Cavour had been dictating the papal policy by telepathic suggestion, he could not have wished for anything better. The defenders of the temporal power behaved with light-hearted insolence of some king in ancient Greek tragedy, whom God has maddened and he may destroy him. The invasion of the Papal States in September 1860 was the crowning act of Cavour's life and the greatest example of his political genius. He was hemmed in on all sides, and he laid all his enemies at his feet by this one stroke. It destroyed the League of Reactionary Italian Powers that threatened the newly formed kingdom in the north. It liberated the populations of the center. It garnered Garibaldi's harvest in the south. It decided the rivalry between himself and the dictator before it could grow into a fatal quarrel. It restored the prestige of the monarchy as at once leading and controlling the revolution, and made it a united Italy stretching without a break from the Alps to Palermo. But proportionate to the possible advantages were the dangers of the course. It was a defiance of Austria, of the whole Catholic world, and of the whole diplomatic world except England. At best, Napoleon might be persuaded to wink at an invasion of papal territory, but he could not fight against Austria in defense of the sacrilege, because his political supporters, his soldiers, his ministers, his ambassadors, and his wife would all be on the side of the Pope. And if Austria chose to attack, Piedmont alone could not resist her armies on the Mincio. Knowing all this, Cavour decided to take the risk. Perhaps no other statesman fully alive to the facts would have dared a venture so hazardous, and certainly none would have carried it through with such perfect nerve and skill. Two men may claim to have advised Cavour before the event, Prince Jerome Napoleon and Ricasoli. As early as June 30th, while Garibaldi was still in Palermo, Prince Jerome had written urging Cavour to break with Naples and the Pope, but to be careful first to take the Emperor into his confidence, and to explain to him without reserve the true necessities of the Italian situation. Cavour waited for 2 months, until Garibaldi was at the gates of Naples, before he followed the Prince's advice. But he spoke of the invasion of the Papal States when it actually took place as the plan of Prince Napoleon, and he gratefully acknowledged Jerome's services in keeping his imperial cousin friendly to the Italian cause and neutralizing the hostile influence of the Empress and the ministers. The necessity for action was also impressed upon Cavour in a series of vigorous letters from Ricasoli, Tuscany's Iron Baron, whose fortitude and patience had carried through the annexation of his province to the territories of Victor Emmanuel. In July 1860, Ricasoli wrote to Cavour again and again, pointing out in impassioned language that the popularity and the prestige of the monarchy was passing over to Garibaldi and the advanced parties who stood behind him, and that nothing short of a war of liberation waged in central Italy by the Piedmontese regular troops could recover for the king moral leadership of the national movement. Ricasoli never tired of repeating his formula, "Our real Garibaldi should be Victor Emmanuel." On the 1st of August, Cavour announced his decision to invade the Papal States, but only in the strictest secrecy, to his representatives at London and Paris. During the whole of the month, the world knew nothing of his intention. At the end of August, Napoleon III was at Cambrai, enjoying the alpine scenery of his new province of Savoy, recently acquired by the bargain with Cavour as the fruits of the Italian alliance. The place, the time, his holiday humor, the constant news from Rome of fresh insults cast upon him by the Pope and the Crusaders, all combined to induce this halter between two opinions to lean for one movement to the liberal side, and at one moment in Cavour's hands sufficed. On August 28th there arrived at Cambrai two Piedmontese emissaries, Farini, the second man in the cabinet of Turin, and Cialdini, the brilliant officer known as the Garibaldi of the regular army. In a secret conference with Napoleon, they informed him of Cavour's intention to invade Umbria and the Marches. The patrimony of St. Peter, by containing the city of Rome, was to be left to the Pope and the French garrison, provided that Napoleon would confine his own troops to that province and leave La Mauricherie with his Austrians and his legitimist French crusaders to try conclusions in Umbria with Cialdini's Bersaglieri. "The Emperor," wrote Cavour, "approved of it all. Indeed, he seemed to greatly relish the idea of seeing La Mauricherie sent to..." The Piedmontese emissaries reported that Napoleon discussed the military chances of the campaign in the most friendly manner, laying down the limits of the plan of operations for our army, and finally dismissed them with the words, "Fait vite, what thou dost do quickly," The southward march of the Piedmontese battalions could be truthfully represented in either of two aspects, liberty or order. Cavour and his agents, in explaining matters to the Emperor, were careful to lay most stress on the restoration of order as against Garibaldi. When the interview took place at Cambrai, the Red Shirts, still in the full career of victory in Calabria, had not yet received their check on the Volturno, and Napoleon had grave reason to fear that they would soon be knocking at the gates of Rome, unless Cavour interposed the shield of the Piedmontese army. It was to the interest alike of Napoleon and of Victor Emmanuel that the Italian monarchy should absorb the revolution before it came up north and involved the whole politics of Italy and France in complications that might end on either side of the Alps in civil war, republican uprising, or legitimist restoration. Not being able to forestall Garibaldi at Naples, wrote Cavour to his minister at Paris, we must stop him elsewhere, that is to say, in Umbria and the Marches. An insurrection is on the point of breaking out there, and as soon as this occurs, in the name of order and humanity, Cialdini enters the Marches and Fanti enters Umbria. They pitch La Marcherie into the sea, occupy Ancona, but declare Rome inviolable. The name of humanity was invoked in reference to the brutal conduct of the Pope's foreign mercenaries, who had repressed the insurrection of Perugia the year before with unnecessary slaughter. Cavour's emissaries represented to Napoleon that it was obligatory to invade the Papal States in order to prevent a repetition of such horrors on a greater scale. An insurrection, they declared, was inevitable in Umbria and the Marches, and truly enough of the inhabitants of Urbino rose and held their hill city for 3 days before Victor Emmanuel's troops crossed the frontier to their rescue. Napoleon, in his official version of the Cambrai interview, declared that he had not only promised his acquiescence because Farini had undertaken on his side at the Piedmontese would only enter the Papal States after an insurrection and to re-establish order. Whatever Napoleon really said or tried afterwards to unsay, he left no doubt in the mind of the two Italians that he would not actively resist the invasion. 3 days later, to make assurance doubly sure, Cavour sent another emissary, Count Arese, the old Italian friend of Napoleon, during the period of his connection with the Carbonari 30 years before. Another tried friend of the adventurer, now safely seated on the throne of France, was Dr. Quesnel, who had aided him in his romantic and perilous escape from the castle of Ham in 1846. In the midst of priests and reactionaries and courtiers, the emperor entirely forgot Arensi and Quesnel in their liberal doctrines, which had once been his own. These two inmates of Napoleon were, at this crisis of Italian history, working in league with Cavour. Arese's instructions were to seek out Napoleon and repeat the arguments of Cialdini and Farini, of which Cavour sent him the following notes for his guidance. Describe to him the Italian situation after Villafranca and Nice. Underhand war continued after Villafranca by enlisting of Austrians and Rome at Naples. Alliance as good as formed between the Pope, Austria, and Bourbons. Feeling of danger of this league very strong in all Italy. After cession of Nice, impossible to hold Garibaldi back. Confess that the government has tolerated and even supported him, but it has energetically prevented Mazzinian expeditions. Impossible to allow ourselves to be distracted by the demagogues at Naples. Once annexation made, we will try not to attack Rome or Austria. Emperor will save Italy if he prevents an attack on us before next spring. If necessary, we will fight alone against Austria. Sure, the Emperor will not allow the only ally of France to be destroyed by coalition. Explain that it is not at Turin but at Paris that we are blamed. These arguments prevailed once more, and the Emperor repeated to Arese his undertaking not to defend the Marches and Umbria with French troops. The history of these negotiations clearly proves that but for Garibaldi's success in the south, Cavour would have had no chance of obtaining Napoleon's passive consent to the invasion of the Papal States. Garibaldi's part in the making of Italy was not confined to the geographical area of the regions which he liberated with his own sword, for the influence of his victories in 1860 was the ruling fact in the dealings of Cavour with Napoleon and with all Europe, to whom he was able to say, "If you won't take Victor Emmanuel, you may get Garibaldi." Hudson's comment when he heard that the Piedmontese were about to invade the Papal States was, "We see now what the Garibaldi expedition has produced." Thus assured from the only quarter whence he could hope to obtain assurance, except from England, whose approval could be taken for granted without the asking, Cavour staked the fortunes of his countrymen on the hazard. An ultimatum launched at the Pope's ministers on September 7th, requiring the disbandment of the foreign mercenaries, who suffocate in Italian blood every expression of the national will, was followed up on September 11th by the invasion of the Marches and of Umbria, and the sailing of Persano's fleet from Naples for the waters of Ancona. Half the regular army was left on the Mincio to protect Milan and Turin against a blow by the Austrians. The guard left was all too feeble, but Cavour trusted that the internal condition of the Austrian Empire would deter the statesmen of Vienna from moving, or ruin them if they moved. He had already made arrangements with the Kossuth and the Magyar leaders for a Hungarian rising to be armed and financed by Italy in case of war between her and Austria. But his hope was that peace could be preserved with Austria until early next year. He could face Europe with the fait accompli of united Italy. The news that Victor Emmanuel's Bersaglieri were marching gaily along the high roads of Umbria and of the Marches, hailed with ecstasies of joy by the inhabitants, and taking in the papal fortress at the rate of one a day, dispelled in an hour the foolish dreams of de Merode and his party. Now was seen how little confidence they had at heart in the crusaders, for whose sake they had thrown away the friendship of Napoleon. At once the whole tribe turned to the man whom they had been insulting for months past, and demanded as a matter of course that he should send the armies of France to save them from the Piedmontese. The demand of the priests was supported by Napoleon's own ambassador in Rome, the Duke de Guermont, and by his foreign minister, Thauvenel, both of them strong reactionaries and neither of them as yet informed of the promise which he had given at Cambrai. He yielded to the clamors of the Catholic world so far as to break off diplomatic relations with Turin, and to protest that he opposed Cavour's act of aggression. But he refused to oppose by force, although the papal ministers, in their agony, added those two little words to the obscure message which de Guermont had been authorized to give them from his master. The priests were accused of deliberate deceit in this matter by the French diplomats. But it must be admitted that de Guermont's oversympathetic personal attitude at the time made it very natural to attach a warlike meaning to the message, which otherwise would have no purpose except to save the emperor's face. End of chapter 10. Chapter 11 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Battle of Castelfiardo and the Fall of Ancona. Ho, maidens of Vienna! Ho, matrons of Lucerne! Weep, weep, and rend your hair for those who never shall return. Ho, Philip, send for charity thy Mexican pistoles, that Antwerp monks may sing a mass for thy poor spearmen's souls. Macaulay. There were 33,000 men in the Italian army that crossed the papal border, vowed, like the Frenchmen at Ivory, to deliver their countrymen from foreigners brought in by priests. Lamoriciere, who had only half his opponent's numbers, could not hope to win unaided, but he might prolong the defense until France or Austria came to the rescue of the Pope. He held all the fortresses in Umbria and the Marches, including the formidable defenses of Ancona. The task imposed on the northern Italian army by Cavour was to destroy Lamoriciere, to take Ancona, and to reach Naples all within a few weeks, under penalty of Austrian attack upon Italy's rear. It was a race against time. General Fanti, the Italian commander-in-chief, one of his two corps under Cialdini crossed the Rubicon, whence Garibaldi had been recalled 10 months before, and made straight along the Adriatic coast towards Ancona, capturing on his way the papal fortress of Pesaro and Fano with their small garrisons. The other corps under General Della Rocca, accompanied by Fanti himself, entered Umbria by the upper Tiber valley at the point where Garibaldi long ago had crossed in his flight with Anita and the remains of the army of the Roman Republic. From Borgo San Sepolcro, the deliverers followed down the poplared banks of the river amid the blessings of the Umbrian peasants, until they reached the foot of the hill on which Perugia stands. The slaughter penetrated there in June 1859 by papal troops under Schmidt, was now avenged by the liberation of the city and the capture of the foreign bully and his 1,500 men after a sharp fight at the San Antonio gate. Della Rocca sent Schmidt away by night under an escort, lest the Perugini should effect their purpose of tearing him to pieces. From Perugia, a detachment under General Brignone was sent to capture the garrison of Spoleto. The town was not defensible, but the Rocca, or medieval castle on the hill above, was in good repair. It contained a monsignor, the clerical governor of the district, and a garrison of 800, of whom 300 Irish and a few score Franco-Belgians were the fighting elements. The castle could, however, be commanded by the artillery and riflemen whom Brignone sent to occupy the wooded mountain on the other side of the gorge, beyond the Lombard aqueduct. For 12 hours of September 17th, the North Italians bombarded the Rocca of Spoleto, and in the afternoon attempted to storm its gate. Almost all the small column of assault were killed or wounded. Both Irish and Northern Italians, here as a few weeks later at Ancona, displayed the ferocious self-sacrifice of men fighting for ideas. The assault was repulsed for that day, but when night fell, the castle was crumbling beneath the bombardment, the ammunition was running out, and the Swiss and Italian populists compelled Major O'Reilly and the boys to open the gates. There is all history's profoundest irony and pathos in this tussle for an old fort in a gash of the wind-grieved Apennine. What quarrel lay between the Piedmontese and the men of Munster that they should have come together in this place of all others to carve each other honourably into mutton? Or what did it profit the peasant of Connaught as he dug his potatoes and paid his rack rent, that the vine-dressers of Umbria should remain enslaved and without fatherland? It is a strange thing, this crossing of sea and land by these Irish, to die for a Monsignor Governor of Spoleto, bade in the last lair of his tyranny. It was to this that generations of England's greatest warriors and statesmen had brought it in their Protestant zeal. Thus does religious bigotry everywhere defeat its own end. Cromwell had planted the Pope's power firm and broad in Ireland, but Gregory the 16th and Pio Nono had destroyed it in Italy. Meanwhile, La Mortuary, knowing that his field force could not give battle on equal terms, either to Fanti in Umbria or to Cialdini in the Marches, had determined to shut himself up in Ancona. His arrival there with his whole army would strengthen and encourage the garrison to hold out until Austria or France should come to the rescue. This plan might well have succeeded had a less enterprising general been in command of the North Italian column on the Adriatic coast. But Cialdini was not called the Garibaldi of the regular army for nothing. As soon as he heard that La Mortuary was moving eastwards by Tolentino and Macerata, he knew that the issue of the campaign lay no longer in Fanti's hands, but in his own, and would depend on the rapidity with which he could throw himself across La Mortuary's path to Ancona. He did not proceed any further along the coast to Ancona, because he feared to be caught under its walls between the formidable garrison within and La Mortuary coming from without. He decided to go round inland by Jesse and Osimo, and stop La Mortuary near Loreto, and he was there obliged to make great demands on the speed and endurance of his men. Two battalions of the Bersaglieri, trained to the quick, springy step that distinguishes their corps, led the way in a forced march by Jesse to Osimo, and thence on to Castelfidardo and Crocette, which the vanguard entered on September 16th, prostrated with heat, hunger, and exhaustion. If the enemy had been able to attack them that evening, they would scarcely have had the physical strength to defend themselves. But Lamoriciere was only beginning to arrive with half his force in Loreto, 3 miles away on the other side of the Musone Valley. His men, though they had not marched so fast as the Bersaglieri, were almost as much exhausted, and the other half of his army, under Pimodin, was not due until the next day. On the 17th, Pimodin came up, but too late for any united movement before nightfall. Cialdini's troops had now all arrived on the scene. And so on the morning of September 18th, the two armies were still watching each other from the hills on either side of the Musone Valley. Both had rested well and recovered from the exhaustion of their forced marches. The best that Lamoriciere could now aspire to do was to creep into Ancona by the track along the coast, at the expense of his baggage and probably some part of his army. He no longer hoped to march in by the high road through Camerano, for the North Italians were planted across it, 16,500 strong to his 6,500. Cialdini, who was holding the line of hills from Osimo to Crocette, had not continued his line across the low ground between Monte d'Oro and the sea, because he had been erroneously informed by his staff officers that the Musone was unfordable in its lower course near its junction with the Aspio. This fault in Cialdini's dispositions, if such it was, though it seemed to give Lamoriciere a chance of slipping past into Ancona, proved in effect the snare that lured him to destruction. Early on the morning of September 16th, Cialdini awoke in Castelfidardo, fully expecting to be attacked by way of the bridge and the high road. At dawn he visited the troops at Crocette, and put all in preparation for defense. With a beating heart he watched the sun suck up the mists out of the Musone Valley, hoping that when the bottom was clear, Lamoriciere's columns would be revealed in the act of crossing. But the valley was empty. The enemy were still on the hills above. After giving orders for his men to pile arms and breakfast, he rode back to Castelfidardo, saying to his staff that after all there would be no battle that day. But meanwhile, in Loreto, the crusaders, gathered together under the dome of the huge Church of the Pilgrims, were kneeling round the famous shrine in the center of the building, the Virgin's House, which, as many of them believed, had been carried in the hands of angels from Palestine to Italy. They were preparing in a very sober mood for a desperate service. Pimodin's force, 3,000 strong, was to cross the ford which had escaped the knowledge of Cialdini's staff, storm the Monte d'Oro, and hold Crocette for a few hours, so as to enable the rest of the army to hurry along the coast to Ancona. More than an hour after Cialdini had returned to Castelfidardo, the first files of Pimodin's column were seen emerging from the woodlands below Loreto and making for the banks of the Musone by way of Erinici. The North Italian army was taken by surprise. Various Austrian battalions, another small body of Irish, and the Franco-Belgian Suaves splashed through the river and fell with all the fury of religious zeal upon two companies of Bersaglieri who had been stationed as outposts in two farms near the river, known as the Lower and Upper House. Some more lukewarm Swiss and native troops followed up across the ford. The Bersaglieri held out in the farms, delaying the advance of the enemy long enough to prevent them from reaching the top of Monte d'Oro before the troops at Crocette had been brought up to its crest. When the crusaders, having at length stormed the two farms, began to push for the top of the hill, they were met by rifle volleys from the wood above, while a battery of artillery unlimbered and opened fire on them down the slope. When the first sounds of the distant battle were heard in the streets of Castelfidardo, Cialdini mounted and galloped back along the ridge. He found the 10th line drawn up on top of the Monte d'Oro. "Colonel!" he cried, so that all the ranks could hear him. pile knapsacks, and charge with bayonet." In another minute the regiment swept like a wave over the edge of the hill and flowed headlong down the side, bearing before it like foam the gilded youth of royalist salons, mingled in the rout with peasants of Bavaria and of Tyrol. For the next half hour the plain between the upper house and the fort of Mousson swarmed with confused masses of Italians, French, Germans, and Irish, trampling hither and thither, bayoneting each other in the frenzy of rage, and firing wildly in every direction. Lamoriciere himself rode into the melee, now far beyond the control of a general officer, only to find his gallant lieutenant, Pimodin, dying in one of the farm buildings. Some of the houses defended to the last by the Papal Suaves were finally set on fire with lighted straw. Meanwhile, the head of the second column of 3,500 men was drawing near the ford. Cialdini's batteries on the hills above opened fire upon them, firing over the heads of the regiments engaged on the north of the river. This second column, though like Pimodin's, it is composed partly of foreigners and partly of Italians, appears to have contained a smaller proportion of good troops. They were first brought to a stand because their own artillery became entangled in the lane along which they were all advancing, and when the round shot came crashing in among them or flying over their heads, when the wounded and the fugitives from the north bank of the river began to stream back past them in terrified crowds, a panic seized the regiments of the rear guard. Before midday the Pope's army, half of which had never fired a shot, was running for dear life to the shelter of the wooded hills, whence they had so recently emerged. Cialdini let loose his lancers upon them. 400 were captured in the valley, and the rest climbed back to St. Mary of Loreto, whose magnificent dome had been in sight of the combatants during all that disastrous morning. Lamoriciere, when he saw the army break up under his eyes, rode off with the staff to find his way into Ancona, taking the coast track by which he had hoped to lead 6,000 men. He was accompanied for 2 miles by a few hundred German-speaking infantry, whose officers had had the presence of mind in the rout to make for the coast instead of retreating by the way they had come. This remnant would have reached Ancona had not Cialdini seen them from the heights of Crocetta, and sent off the ninth line at a double to go round by Concio Hill and cut them near Umana. As the Germans were struggling along ankle-deep in the sand beside the Blue Adriatic, the Italians appeared over the rocks at a few paces distance and began to fire into their flank, literally driving them into the sea. The infantry had no choice but to surrender. Lamoriciere and 45 horsemen alone escaped to Ancona and entered its gates between 5 and 6 in the evening. The garrison, recognizing the general for whom they had been waiting all day, broke out into shouts of joy, and the governor, Quattrobarbis, came down to welcome him. "I am here," he said, "but I have lost the army." There was no more cheering heard that night in Ancona. Meanwhile, Cialdini had crossed the valley of the Mousson and accepted the surrender of some 3,000 crusaders around the shrine of Loreto. 2 or 3,000 more flung away their arms and dispersed. Most of these latter were natives who now attempted to pass through the countryside, changing their clothes and resuming their real character of Italian peasants. But in the course of the next few days, the greater part of them were captured by Cialdini's flying columns. Except the garrison of Ancona and a few small bodies near Rome, the crusaders had been wiped off Italian soil. The utter catastrophe of Castelfidardo, within a week after the opening of the campaign, acted as a strong deterrent to Austrian designs of interference. But there were still grave reasons for the invaders to take Ancona with the least possible delay. The city was Austria's traditional port of entry into central Italy. Until the year before, she had held it with her own troops, and even now it was garrisoned by her veterans, diplomatically disguised as papal soldiers. Its fall would be felt at Vienna as a serious blow. It would be easy, and it was tempting for Austria, by use of her fleet, to preserve the city from capture, as a preliminary to more active interference. Such, at least, were the fears entertained at Turin. Napoleon's fait vite must still be the motto of the campaign. The siege was pushed with energy on the land side. Batteries were placed scientifically in position, and the bombardment began. At the storming of various outer works, both sides showed great courage, and Quatrebarbus, the governor of Ancona, was amazed by the zeal of a small body of Irish under his command. But his most vulnerable side was towards the sea. After a week's delay, which the event seemed to prove unnecessary, Persano, on September 28th, ordered his fleet to steam in close to the fortifications of the harbour and blow them to pieces. The order was gallantly executed, and after a severe duel ending with the explosion of a powder magazine in the fortifications of the lighthouse, the defence of Ancona collapsed. On September 29th, the formal surrender took place of Lamoriceri, Quatrebarbus, and the whole garrison of 4,000 to 6,000 men. The Pope's generals and soldiers were treated with scrupulous courtesy by their captors, who knew that all over the world jealous eyes were watching for a chance to censure the conduct of the new Italian state. Nothing now stood in the way of the entry of the North Italian army into the Neapolitan kingdom. The province of Abruzzi, contiguous to Umbria and the Marches, had already risen and established a provisional government in the name of Italy, Victor Emmanuel and Garibaldi dictator. The leaders of this provincial rising showed both spirit and sense. Fearing a reactionary movement in the form of anarchy and brigandage, they petitioned Victor Emmanuel towards the end of September to cross the Tronto and annex the Neapolitan kingdom without more delay. Similar addresses reached him from the inhabitants of Naples. These petitions aroused Garibaldi's indignation because they contained sharp criticism of his dictatorship, and even spoke of his friends as a stupid and incorrigible faction. And besides, he still wished the annexation to be postponed, because he had not yet ceased to hope that the military situation on the Volturno would so far change for the better as to enable him to march on Rome. But he never for one moment entertained the idea of resisting the advance of the northern Italian army, even if it were to come sooner than he wished. His horror of civil war between the patriotic parties was one of those simple, fixed ideas that guided his sometimes too impulsive conduct throughout the whole course of his life. Garibaldi's loyalty was soon put to the proof. On September 23rd, Tripoti, who commanded the Garibaldian force at Teramo in Abruzzi, asked for instructions in case the North Italian vanguard appeared on the frontier. Bertani sent back word from Naples, "If the Piedmontese wish to enter, say to them that before you permit it, you must ask instructions from the dictator." Having dispatched this correct reply, the secretary went up to the lines next day to consult Garibaldi, who immediately sent word to Tripoti, "If the Piedmontese enter our territory, receive them like brothers." On September 27th, 2 days before the fall of Ancona, and 4 days before the Battle of the Volturno, Garibaldi issued the following proclamation, characteristically inaccurate and characteristically loyal and generous: "Our brothers of the Italian army commanded by the brave General Cialdini are fighting the enemies of Italy and conquering. The army of Lamoriceri has been defeated by these brave men. All the provinces subject to the Pope are free. Ancona is ours. Our brave soldiers of the northern army have passed the frontier and are on Neapolitan territory. We shall soon have the good fortune to press these victorious hands." But the North Italian army still had to traverse some 200 miles of road before it could reach Capua. Nearly another month was to pass before they arrived on the scene, and during that month Francis II had still the time, if he had the strength, to cut his way back to Naples over the ruins of Garibaldi's army. If he had succeeded, the moral effect of such a reversal on the public mind in Italy, Austria, and France would have rendered it impossible for Victor Emmanuel to turn him out once more, and European interference would have supervened in one form or another on behalf of a king who had won his way back to the allegiance of his subjects. The fate of Italy still hung on the issue of Garibaldi's defense of his lines before Capua. End of chapter 11. Chapter 12 of Garibaldi and the Making of Italy by George Macaulay Trevelyan. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. The Eve of the Volturno. Ti fatta onde aquila in agguato, sapia presso il lungi tutto il fume e il piano di vastima pugna incendiato. Moradi, Rhapsodia Garibaldina. Ti fatta's summit, whence an eagle in an ambush, he watches near and far all the river and the plain, far round ablaze with the fires of war. The military position on the Volturno was in itself an additional inducement to Garibaldi to acquiesce in the coming of Victor Emmanuel. By the middle of September, his observations from the summit of Monte Tifata had shown him not only the uselessness for the time being of any attempt on his part to attack Capua, but the grave danger in which his own army would stand if General Ritucci ventured on a counterattack. In order to distract the enemy's attention from any such design, he sent a few hundred men under the Hungarian Kisfati to the north bank of the Volturno, with a roving commission to join hands with liberal insurgents anywhere between Cajazzo and Rome. Some bands around Alife and Piedmont had been in arms for 3 weeks past. With their help, Kisfati was to threaten the line of Ritucci's communications behind Capua, and so prevent him from making a forward move. But Garibaldi had no intention of attempting to hold Cajazzo or any other post north of the river, still less of attacking the walls of Capua. Such was the state of affairs when he was called away on September 16th to pay a political visit to Palermo. The pressing demand of the Sicilians, headed by his own pro-dictator, De Pretis, for immediate annexation to Piedmont, required his presence. Tor, whom he left in command on the Volturno, ought not to have taken any important new step in his absence. But Tor's fault as a soldier was rashness, as he had shown the year before at Treponti. Finding himself in command for 3 days, he formed the ambitious scheme of occupying and holding Cajazzo, a hill town north of the Volturno, a far more serious undertaking than the irresponsible gyrations of Kisfati's flying column. In order to distract Ritucci's attention from Cajazzo, Tor made a reconnaissance in force against Capua on September 19th, the day after the Battle of Castelfidardo. The reconnaissance procured, indeed, the unopposed occupation of Cajazzo, but was still itself ill-conducted and disastrous. At dawn, Rusto's Milanese drove the enemy's advance guard into Capua, but then, instead of retiring from before the walls, remained for 2 hours round the railway station and on the open parade ground exposed to the fire of the cannon on the bastions. They retreated after severe losses, and the Bourbon troops sallied out after them from the gate, led on by old General Rosarro, who, though on the retired list, rode to the sound of the firing and headed the advance in gallant style, until he was carried off wounded. Rusto's men made a stand at the cemetery and Cappuccino convent and drove the royalists back to Capua. But the events of September 19th had at least all the appearance of a repulse for the Garibaldini, who had fired at the walls as if they intended to take Capua by a coup de main. Indeed, some of the officers who served that day under Rusto still believe that he was inspired by a secret hope that the gates would be opened to him by treachery, though he never confessed as much. The day cost the Garibaldini 130 in killed and wounded. Meanwhile, the dictator had settled affairs in Sicily. The love the people bore to him overcame their strong desire for annexation and their indifference to his projects on Rome. He had another magnificent popular reception in Palermo on September 17th. He replaced the pro-dictator De Prentice by Mordini, who had hitherto been more opposed to Cavour, but Mordini was a man capable of learning by experience, and although Crispi tried to poison his mind with false rumours of treachery on the part of Cavour, the new ruler of Sicily had by the middle of October discovered the absolute necessity for the immediate annexation of the island to Piedmont. Garibaldi returned to the banks of the Volturno on the afternoon of September 19th, too late for the fighting under the walls of Capua, but in time to join Tour in a duel, which he was carrying on with the enemy's forces on the other side of the river, across the ferry of Formicola. There is no reliable evidence as to what he said to Tour that day, but he afterwards wrote in severe condemnation of his lieutenant for the attack on the walls of Capua and for the occupation of Cajazzo. The events of September 19th, especially the sally of the Bourbon troops under the old general Rossaro, gave self-confidence to those forces and suggested to them the idea that they might successfully take the offensive on a great scale. That evening the Minister of War at Gaeta sent Ritucci the King's orders to march forward seeking and find and destroy the enemy at the same time advance on the capital. Ritucci thereupon set before the King a plan for an advance on the capital by the country roads to the east of San Tammaro, which passing through Arone and Vico, Foresta and Castel di Principe, unite at Naples on the side of Capodimonte. Garibaldi in his memoirs declares that the enemy would in this way have succeeded in reaching Naples if his own force had meanwhile been held in check by false attacks. But the plan was rejected as too dangerous by its author, Ritucci, who opposed as still more rash the frontal attack on Santa Maria and San Angelo, recommended by the royal councillors at Gaeta. All that Ritucci would as yet consent to do was to recover Cajazzo. The dictator made his one military mistake of this year in not withdrawing from Cajazzo the 300 Bolognese under Cattabini, whom Tour had without his consent placed in that isolated position across the river. Matters were only made worse by the dispatch of another 600 men under Vacchieri. There were now 900 men collected in the hill town to hold it against any force that might come along the high road from Capua. On September 21st, the best regiments in Ritucci's army, the native Cacciatori, with a battery of guns and a reserve of three fine Swiss and German regiments, some 7,000 in all, came to retake Cajazzo. After a gallant defense of several hours conducted by Cattabini, who fell into the enemy's hands severely wounded, the town was stormed, sacked, and burnt by the Bourbon troops. The victors confessed to a loss of over 100. About 250 of the Garibaldini were killed, wounded, or captured, and the Swiss, who took no part in the sack, observed with compassion that many of the wounded were mere boys. Two-thirds of the defenders under Vacchieri escaped with difficulty by fording the flooded ferry of Limatola. After the storming of Cajazzo, the Bourbon troops were prepared for any adventure. The spell had so long bound them was well nigh broken, for they had proved that they could defeat the Red Devils, at least where the magician himself was not present. The king's counsellors in Gaeta, who had learnt the disastrous news of Castelfidardo, perceived that unless they could at once cut their way back to Naples, their position on the Volturno, however impregnable in front, would be taken in rear by the victorious armies of Piedmont. They therefore overruled Ritucci's objections and compelled him against his will to lead his troops to the general attack on the enemy's lines. There was one chance left for the House of Bourbon on this earth, and if the attack had been made within 2 or 3 days after the victory of Cajazzo, before Garibaldi had erected his batteries at Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo, and if Ritucci's whole striking force had been directed in one solid mass against those two villages, it is difficult to see how it could have failed to succeed. But again, there was the delay of a week, and again there was the division of forces. For both these errors the councillors at Gaeta were responsible. For although they had done well in compelling Ritucci to fight, they spoilt it all by dictating to him a plan of battle of which he rightly disapproved. They were unnecessarily alarmed for the safety of the rear and flank of Ritucci's position, conceiving it to be threatened by the really negligible activities of Casfati and the liberal bands round Piedmont and Ricca Romana. The council at Gaeta, therefore, compelled the master-in-chief to send great forces under von Mitchell to restore order in that district, and thence to push them on to Amorosi and Ducenta. This not only caused a week's delay, but drew the royalists on to adopt the false strategy of attacking Garibaldi on two sides. Not only from Capua by way of Santa Maria and Sant'Angelo, but also from Ducenta by way of Maddaloni. It appears that after the storming of Cajazzo, some of the advisers at Gaeta felt so completely confident of victory and of a submissive reception in Naples that they were planning rather to make victory complete than to make it secure. Misled by the golden hope of surrounding the enemy's headquarters at Caserta from east and west at once, they took the unnecessary risk of operating on an outer semicircle, of which the two ends were not in effective communication. They thus gave to Garibaldi, with his smaller force, the advantage of acting on the inner ring, or rather along the straight diameter, while their communications ran round the circumference of the semicircle. This advantage he used to the utmost on the day of battle, with the help of the railway line running from Maddaloni through Caserta to Santa Maria. The effect of this plan was to divide the Bourbon army into two separate forces, one under Ritucci at Capua and the other under von Mitchell operating round Ducenta. Von Mitchell, the brave Swiss whose stupidity in May had been one of the chief causes of Garibaldi's capture of Palermo, was nominally under the orders of Ritucci, but he chose to act as if he had an independent command, and left the commander-in-chief without news of him for days together. On the 28th, Ritucci, in despair, rode out from Capua as far as Cajazzo, in search of the missing von Mitchell, and finally discovered that he had, on the 26th, advanced southwards from Amorosi through Ducenta as far as the crossroads at Cantinella, and thence had sent out cavalry who located Bixio's force covering Maddaloni near the arches of the valley. Von Mitchell had thereupon retired again as far as Amorosi on September 27th. If he had on that day made a determined assault on Maddaloni, while Ritucci in concert sallied out in force from Capua against Santa Maria, they would have had a good chance of meeting at Caserta that evening. But owing to their entire want of communication, the great effort was postponed until the 1st of October. This delay, wrote Ritucci to von Mitchell, when at last he was able to renew correspondence with his lieutenant, may well be fatal to our cause. Ritucci was sulky, but prepared to carry out with vigor the orders which he disliked. His men were elated at the prospect of battle, and confident that they would sleep in Caserta the first night and in Naples the next. Their prospects were indeed bright, but they would have been still brighter if the attack had not been deferred till the beginning of October. On September 27th, Garibaldi had only half a dozen field guns and no entrenched batteries in his lines against Capua, but in the last 3 days of the month he and his men labored day and night at planting cannon that arrived from Naples and throwing up defenses in their front. In this they received skilled assistance from Dowling, a British ex-sergeant of artillery who had been in service before Sebastopol, two ex-captains of Bourbon artillery, and 20 gunners of the Piedmontese regular army, sent up from Naples on the night of the 29th at the request of Garibaldi to Villamarina, and followed on the next day by 40 more of their number. One of the new batteries was on the road between Sant'Angelo and Capua. Another was in the middle of the scattered village of Sant'Angelo itself. A third intended to fire at the enemy's batteries across the river, was erected on top of the precipitous ridge of San Giorgio, whither the guns were dragged with great labor and considerable engineering skill. Finally, a battery was placed at the entrance of Santa Maria, under the ancient Roman archway which spans the road leading from Old to New Capua. There were other mobile trains of artillery on the road between Sant'Angelo and Santa Maria. For the last time in his life, Garibaldi had all his ablest lieutenants with him. Avenzana, the former war minister of the Roman Republic, arrived just in time to help his old friend to set his batteries round San Angelo. Cosenz was doing his best to make bricks without straw as war minister in Naples. Sertori was at the front as chief of staff. Bixio was defending Maddaloni against von Mitchell. Medici held San Angelo and Monte Tavata. Milbitz held Santa Maria. Tor was stationed with the reserves at Caserta, ready to bring them up by rail, either to Maddaloni or to Santa Maria, as need should require at the crisis of the battle. By this last simple device, Garibaldi obtained the full advantage of being on the inside of the circle, of acting on the diameter while the enemy moved round by the circumference. In spite of these preparations, which greatly strengthened his position in the last 3 days of September, his army was still in evil case. 20,000 men, the greater part of them ill-armed and worse drilled, many scarcely knowing how to use their rifles, had to stand the shock of 28,000 or 30,000 regular troops, coming on in the full confidence of victory. Exhausted with starvation, exposure, and overwork, many of the best men were physically prostrated, while the cowards were slinking back to Naples or preparing to fly at the first onset. There was none of that certain assurance of victory which had carried them through Sicily and Calabria. In the coming battle, Garibaldi had to depend upon his own military genius, which was seldom seen to better advantage than on that desperate day, and on the resolve to die at their posts which his presence inspired into the few thousand men who were really doing the work of the whole army. The spirit in the Garibaldian lines on the eve of the Volturno is illustrated by a story told by the English preacher Howes, who a fortnight later met a young Milanese noble at the siege of Capua. He was poorly equipped and almost in rags. He had nothing but a sword and a pistol. "What induced you," I said, "to give up ease and luxury for this life of a dog in a camp without commissariat pay or rations?" "You may well ask," he said. "I tell you, a fortnight ago I was in despair myself, and thought of giving up the whole thing. I was sitting on a hillock, as might be here. Garibaldi came by. He stopped, I don't know why. I had never spoken to him. I am sure he did not know me, but he stopped. Perhaps I looked very dejected, and indeed I was. Well, he laid his hand on my shoulder and simply said, with that low, strange, smothered voice that seemed almost like a spirit speaking inside me, 'Courage, courage! We are going to fight for our country.' Do you think I could ever turn back after that?" The next day we fought the Battle of the Volturno. End of chapter 12.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.